telling her for the 10th time to turn off her iPod and do her chores. Except her dad didn't have that creepiness in his voice. That wet, syrupy evil. Her throat dried out. When the projector was on, it was impossible to see beyond its beam to the darkness beyond. It was like having a conversation with a psycho ghost. I got tired. I couldn't sleep last night. Couldn't because she'd been crying for her mom and dad, for her little brother, Ryan, and her cat, Freckles. She wanted her family. She wanted her room. She wanted her friends. She even wanted witchy Mrs. Zahner.
Is there anything else?
I want to go home. She stomped her foot, the words tumbling out of her as rage shoved aside fear for the moment. Let me go! She yanked at the chain securing one wrist to the steel bar. It clanked in rhythm with her shouts. Take me home! Take me home now, you fucking freak! The demand ended on a shriek.
I'm afraid you've made your situation worse.
The voice was mild, but disapproval threaded through it.
Now you've broken rules 4 and 5 as well. I can only assume that you're willfully disobeying.
The fury that had welled up inside her vanished, as if it had been sucked away by a vacuum. Fear did a fast sprint up her spine. I didn't mean to. What would he do now? Would he come up here? Would he touch her? Would he make her do disgusting things with him? Her mind scrambled away from that thought. Please, no. Please, God, no. I'm sorry.
I know you are, dear. But with every choice comes a consequence. However, I've always felt that each misbehavior is an opportunity for reteaching. So let's go over the rules again.
I have them memorized. I just got tired. Consequences? At home, a consequence was being grounded, having to do Ryan's chores when she was mean to him. One time she had to make dinner all by herself, because her mom had gotten tired of her complaining about what they were having. But that hadn't been bad. She could just make spaghetti and garlic bread just as well as her mom. And afterward, it had even been sort of fun, with her dad making a big deal out of being scared to taste it, and Ryan pretending he was choking. Her mom had eaten 3 bites and smiled at her, calling her my little chef. Whitney's eyes filled with tears. She'd make dinner every night. She'd do all of Ryan's chores forever, if she could just go home again.
I'm waiting.
The voice had gone stern. She wet her lips. Rule number 1, I may use the bed from 9 p.m. to 7:15 a.m. Rule number 2, shower from 7:15 to 7:20. Brush teeth, comb hair, and get dressed from 7:20 to 7:30. Breakfast from 7:30 to 7:55. Practice begins sharply at 8. She was alerted to each of the times by a loud buzz from the computer, and she'd already discovered what happened when she slept through the morning alarm. The water ran only during that time, so she'd have to go without a shower or water to brush her teeth. Food for the daily meals was waiting on the opposite side of the stage when she woke up each morning. A couple of pieces of fruit, 2 small plastic bottles of milk, a pair of wrapped peanut butter sandwiches, granola bars, and a small box of dry cereal. The thought of him sneaking the food in here without her being aware, maybe watching her sleep, made her want to puke. She'd even tried to stay awake so she could see him putting it there. It seemed important that she knew what he looked like. When she got out of here, she might have to give a description so the police could arrest him and let him rot in prison. She hoped bad things happened to him there. She hoped someone killed him in prison. Rule number 3. Whitney paused, wondering if he'd hear the hatred in her voice. Toilet use at 7:15 a.m. and every 4 hours, precisely until bedtime. She'd almost peed her pants that first night, waiting for morning. But she hadn't dared to break one of his stupid rules until just now, and had been busted for it. Number 4. No shouting, arguing, or pouting. 5. No rudeness, name-calling, profanity, or vulgarity of any sort. It was a good thing he couldn't read her mind. A really good thing. Because he was a fucking asshole, and she wished he was dead. She started then, backed an inch closer to the wall. She still couldn't see him, but he felt closer. The bravado left her, and she began to tremble like a leaf in a windstorm. Rule number
six.
Dread snaked and twisted nastily in her stomach. His voice did sound nearer. Why was it so dark in here? She strained to see, even as her mind grappled for the next rule. Never give less than my best effort at practice. God, he was worse than her dance instructor had ever been. And she'd taken lessons from Tammy J for 10 years, before she'd finally quit a few months ago.
You may skip number 7 since you already repeated it. Rule number 8?
Yeah, she'd like to skip number 7. She had to follow the routine on the same film every day. Hour after hour of warming up, practicing the positions 1 through 5, then bar exercises. The metal bar on the stone wall behind her ran 3/4 of the way across the stage. Her chain was attached to a sliding mechanism on it that let her move its length. Lucky her. Then it was demi-pliés and arabesques until her muscles were like jello. Tendu and rond de jambe until she wanted to scream. It was all beginner stuff she'd learned when she was a little kid. And always at the end, there was a simple dance routine that combined all the movements. Mind-numbing monotony that gave her way too much time to think. Was that the scrape of a shoe? Was he coming up here? Whitney stumbled backward until she felt the bar at her back. Rule number 8, privileges are earned for good behavior and punishment for bad. Like being lied to, kidnapped in the middle of the night, and kept in a dungeon wasn't punishment enough? Rule number 9, never try to escape. Fat chance. She spent every waking moment trying to figure a way out of here. But so far she'd come up with nothing. She repeated the rest of the damned rules like an automaton, hating the unseen man more with every word.
Excellent. Let's go back to rule number 8, shall we?
Fear fisted in her belly. She wanted to go home. Oh, God, why couldn't she go home? I said I was sorry. It was like she hadn't spoken.
Strip naked, folding your clothes neatly. As I told you before, if you refuse, I'll come up and do it for you.
No, 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 no. A silent scream of protest howled through her. He'd given her the leotard and tights to put on and taken her clothes that first day. Only the threat that he'd change her himself had had her stripping before him then, awkward with haste, wanting to bear as little as possible. One sleeve of the leotard unfastened at the seam with Velcro, which allowed for the chain. How long had he been planning this? The thought of his hands on her made her body convulse in revulsion. Slowly, fingers stiff with resistance, she took off the clothes, piece by piece. Ballet slippers, scuffed and barely white anymore. Leotard, tights, everything in her size, or close enough. Her body racked with trembling as she hesitated on her bra.
You have 10 more seconds.
That had her moving. She could slide the released garment down her secured arm only to the length of chain. And when she removed the panties, shame and disgust crawled over her skin. Knowing he was out there, looking at her. But, oh God, if he touched her. She couldn't handle that. Every news show she'd ever seen about a missing kid flashed through her mind again, and she started to pray all the prayers that Pastor Mickelson had ever taught at Bible camp, and that was a lot.
Now come to the front of the stage as far as the chain will allow, and get down on your hands and knees. Face the wall. Quickly now.
She moved as directed, crouching to clasp her knees, trying to make herself as small as possible.
The rules are ranked in ascending order, up to the most important.
His voice sounded more distant now. Something had shut down inside her. She was going far away.
And of course, breaking the most important rules result in more serious consequences. A lash for each one broken. That's 5, in case you lost track.
Alarm filtered through her numbed mind as she heard the snap. She raised her head, tried to look over her shoulder when the first flick of the whip cut through her skin. Searing agony exploded across her back. All thought vanished as the whip fell again and again, slashing skin, bruising muscle. On the third blow, Whitney started to scream.
Janie Willard. November 4th, 10:43 a.m.
Janie?
Mr. Latham folded his arms across his chest, resting them on top of the pudge of his belly that strained the buttons on his sweat-stained shirt.
We don't have all day. Name one comparison and one contrast between the Greek god Ares with his Roman counterpart Mars.
It wasn't that she hadn't heard him. Of course she had. And she knew the answer. But as soon as he called her name for the first time, her heart had sped up until its pounding rocketed in her chest. She tried to moisten her lips, but her mouth was dry. Knots tightened in her stomach as she felt everyone in the room looking at her, mocking her. So stupid, she doesn't know anything, weirdo. That's your imagination. It isn't real. Dr. Drake's words sounded in her mind as she struggled to lasso her careening thoughts. No one is judging you. No one but the sadist in front of the room, his ample ass hitched on a corner of the desk.
Ares.
The violent hammering of her heart sounded in her ears. Her palms felt like a flash flood had struck. They're both...
Mr. Latham, you know Janie doesn't talk.
A few titters followed Heather's interruption.
It's just mean to try and make her. It's like punishing a dog that can't learn to shake hands.
Outright laughter now, from more than a few.
It's really not fair to the dog.
The teacher's indulgent smile diffused his next words.
Heather, that's not appropriate.
The burning inside Janie's chest turned to anger. No real weight behind the reprimand, not for Heather Miller. Because when Latham accidentally pushed books off his desk, Heather was one girl who was always willing to go up front and pick them up for him, usually making certain he got an excellent look at her cleavage when she bent down to retrieve them. Heather had never said no when asked, as Janie had, in an automatic, emphatic explosion of sound that had left Latham red-faced and her classmates howling with laughter. Sometimes, pride could come to her rescue, beating back the waves of panic. She battled for it now, the words coming out of her in a rush.
Ares and Mars.
They were both considered gods of war, but the Greek god Ares wasn't revered by the people, where the Roman god Mars was given a more dignified... The bell rang, and there was an instantaneous shuffling of feet of possessions being gathered. Latham got up to circle his desk and peer down at his lesson plan.
Quiz tomorrow, and you'll be asked to compare and contrast Greek and Roman gods. Make sure you bone up on them.
Boner exam, some guy in the back muttered, and laughter burst out again. Latham looked up, frowning.
Who said that?
Everyone was crowding toward the front in a wall of people that always had Janie remain glued to her chair until they'd passed. She could feel someone at her side. Knew without looking who it would be. I hear the most prestigious school scholarships value communication more even than test scores. Heather's voice sounded in her ear. I hope you realize you'll have to do a verbal presentation. The days of you getting a free pass because of your poor dead sister are almost over.
Shut up!
As comebacks went, it ranked at about first grade level. But it was all Janie could manage. Impotent fury was welling, most of it directed inward. She hated the anxiety that could still grip her, but even more, she hated allowing herself to be victimized by it. Stuffing her laptop in her backpack, she stood suddenly, and Heather stumbled back a few steps, only to be brought up short by a desk. She placed her hand on it, as if bracing herself from falling.
"Don't push me!"
her voice rang out.
What? What's going on?
As the last cluster of students headed through the doorway, Latham looked their way, frowning again.
Nothing, Mr. Latham.
Heather winced, cradling her wrist in her other hand.
I'll be fine.
He marched down the aisle toward them, his dark mustache twitching in irritation.
What's wrong with your hand? Are you hurt?
Janie's gaze bounced between Heather and the teacher incredulously. He was actually buying this farce? Not really. I banged it on the desk when Janie shoved me, but I didn't. It was as if Janie hadn't spoken.
To the office, both of you. Heather, have the nurse look at your wrist. Janie, see Mrs. Rimble.
What? The scene was taking on a cartoonish aspect. Why?
Because I said so. Now go.
He'd already turned away. Students for the next period were straggling in. Temper nearly choking her, Janie strode toward the door. In light of Heather's words, it was somehow worse being sent to Rimble, the counselor, and not Templeton, the dean of students. She stopped, waiting impatiently for a couple of girls to stop talking, and then followed them through the doorway. But Heather was full of shit if she thought Janie hadn't earned every good grade and test score on her own. And she'd managed it without flashing her boobs at that creeper Latham. Behind her, she heard, "Oh, that's such a good call, Mr. Latham. Janie is probably a little on edge because of that missing girl from Saxon Falls. I'm sure it reminds her of her sister." Janie shouldered her way through the jammed hallways, her free hand clenched at her side. She'd figured out the Heather Millers of the world long ago. They were experts at sizing up people's vulnerabilities and then pressing the right button every chance they got. Heather was more accomplished than most because somehow she always managed to be the wounded party. Anger scorched Janie's stomach as she made her way toward the office. Latham wouldn't cut her the slightest slack when it came to making a speech in front of the class, but he lacked the balls to send her to Templeton. And she knew exactly what was behind his sudden solicitousness. The days of you getting a free pass because of your poor dead sister are almost over. There was a kernel of truth in the taunt. Between the accommodations required for her social anxiety and her family tragedy, there were few teachers in the school who didn't treat her just a little bit differently from other students. Barely perceptible, but the kid gloves were there. Which was another reason she was determined to attend college as far away from West Bend, Ohio as possible. There was nothing that burned quite as much as pity. Kelsey would have despised it even more than Janie did. She was jostled again by the wall of students, this time harder. Janie tried to right herself but tripped over something and fell to all fours. A knee to her back sent her sprawling face first. "Oh, goodness, Janie, are you hurt?" A voice ringing through the hallway was instantly recognizable. A moment later, Heather crouched gracefully down beside her, her hand extended. "Let me help you." It was unplanned. Automatic. Janie reached out a hand to grasp Heather's before yanking her down hard. Off balance, the other girl toppled to the floor, wrapping her face smartly on the edge of the laptop she clutched. On cue, the perfect nose her parents had bought for her 2 summers earlier began to gush. Heather stemmed the flow with her fingers, looking at the bright red blood with disbelief, quickly followed by rage. "You bitch!" Her hand flew out, slapping Janie with enough force to snap her head to the side. She dropped her things and launched herself toward Janie, fingers curled. She clamped her hands around Heather's wrists, struggling to keep the other girl's nails from raking her face.
"Can't fight! Throw a punch! Lose the clothes!"
The crowd around them began to swell, then was abruptly parted.
"That's enough! Heather, enough!"
One moment Janie was dangerously close to losing an eye, the next, the other girl was gone, lifted away and held tightly by... Janie's heart took a nosedive. Susan Booker, the principal. Shit.
"She started it! I was just trying to help her up, and she..."
Predictably, Heather dissolved into tears.
"She hit me! Look at my nose!"
Slowly, Janie gathered her things and got up. As she rose, she glanced at the crowd of students being dispersed by a couple of teachers and felt everything inside her go to ice. Her lungs clogged, anxiety balled in her chest, spreading its tentacles to curl around her heart. Squeeze! She was the center of attention and for a moment couldn't move. "Speak. Breathe."
"Janie!"
The principal's voice cracked like a whip as she moved Heather away with a hand at her back.
"To the office. Rest of you, get to class."
I don't know whether to be baffled at this turn of events or proud. Janie's surprised gaze met Rimble's for the first time since entering her office moments ago. She'd sat outside the counselor's door for a couple of hours. She hadn't seen Heather, but that was unsurprising. The outer offices were a rabbit warren of exits, inside hallways, and smaller rooms. The nurse's room was next to the principal in the interior space. Rimble had just appeared moments ago. Janie could guess where she'd been. On the one hand, I'm disappointed that you engaged in violence, which is never the answer to solving problems. But I've known you for 4 years, Janie. Lori Rimble clasped her hands on the table, separating them, and leaned forward. And I realized what it cost you to stand up for yourself this way when you're being bullied at school. Eyes widening in shock, Janie could only stare. This was definitely not the conversation she'd expected to hear after bloodying Heather Miller's nose. I'm not bullied. Bullied implied victimhood, and she'd never allow herself to be that vulnerable. She might have been powerless to prevent what happened to her sister and the toll it took on her and her parents, but she'd fought for years against the diagnosis that could control her life if she let it. She was nobody's victim. You didn't let yourself be. A smile flickered at the corners of the woman's lips before she firmed them. But, as I mentioned, your response was ill-advised. That said, there were several witnesses to the altercation in the hallway and in Mr. Latham's class before that. I believe Mrs. Booker has been quite thorough in talking to all of them and has a clear picture of what transpired. Would you like to tell your side of things? Wary, she remained silent. She was vaguely familiar with the progressive discipline policy at the school, although she'd never thought to find herself on this end of it. Rimble smiled wryly. I thought not. Mrs. Booker has decided, and I agree, that this matter would best be handled at the minimal level of consequences. Neither you nor Heather has ever been in trouble before, and both have distinguished academic records. I will warn you that if there's another occurrence of this behavior, it will be dealt with more severely. And as your friend, I want to caution you that by allowing yourself to be manipulated into a reaction, you're playing into Heather's jealousy of you. Manipulated. The arrow hit its mark. It was another moment before the rest of the counselor's words registered. Jealousy? Janie was incredulous. Heather? The idea that anyone would be jealous of her was hard to fathom. That Heather would be was downright unbelievable. For the first time, the counselor's expression looked stern. Don't sell yourself short, Janie. You and Heather are at the top of your class. Don't give her an edge. Without allowing Janie time to digest her advice, she went on. Heather will serve her after-school suspension tomorrow. Yours will be Friday. Her smile was back. Now, is there anything you'd like to say? Janie shook her head, still mentally reeling. Then you can go. Your father is here and will take you home for the day, but don't forget what I said. Given the recent news stories, I know this is going to be a difficult time for you and your family. I'm here to help if you'll let me. Blindly, Janie rose, went to the door. She could have told the woman that there was nothing she could do. Nothing anyone could do. The longer Whitney DeVries remained missing, the worse it was going to get for the Willards.
Claire Willard, November 4th, 11:35 a.m. As she sat on the edge of Kelsey's unmade bed, Claire could feel the tight fist in her chest loosen for the first time since she'd heard the news of Whitney's disappearance. David had done his usual pulling away after she'd appeared at his office. She'd known better, but had been unable to stop herself. Sipping from her third drink since Janie left that morning, she fingered the pills in the pocket of her robe. She didn't take them indiscriminately, because it was getting harder and harder to find doctors who would prescribe them. Claire still recalled her shock and fury 3 years ago when her family doctor, Dr. Schultz, had refused to renew the prescription of antidepressants and sedatives he'd begun prescribing after Kelsey had been kidnapped. His words had slashed like jagged little daggers, even cloaked as they'd been in a kindly manner. The upshot of that appointment had been that even the medical profession placed parameters on suffering, and apparently she'd hit hers the fourth year after Kelsey was taken. She squeezed the glass in a grip that made her knuckles ache. Before this, she hadn't known that grief came with an unwritten statute of limitations. There should be a handbook documenting them for families of victims, so they wouldn't be blindsided when hit with one. A one-year maximum for a messy divorce, maybe two for the passing of a spouse. Surely the death of a child deserved an extra year or two. No matter. She'd outgrieved the limits, and then she'd been cut off. Claire had been reduced to doctor shopping, like some common junkie desperate for a script. She resented that almost as much as she had Dr. Schultz's final words. "Claire, you need help that you aren't going to get from the pills. Why not try therapy again?" She'd listened to enough psychologists jabbering about the seven stages of grief to know that David had worked his way through them all, moving along to acceptance and hope at what medical professionals would approvingly call a healthy pace. Claire brought the glass to her lips and drank deeply. She also knew that David had left her at a distant stage four, depression, reflection, and loneliness, while he'd made his lapse. That was, perhaps, the greatest betrayal of all. "Mrs. Wheelert, I'm leaving for the day, unless there's anything else." Claire looked up, summoned a smile. Marta stood framed in the doorway, wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and a concerned expression. Her apparel was a vast improvement over the ridiculous gray dress and apron their former cleaning service had required of their employees. David frowned whenever he saw the maid. He was a stickler about appearances. But he was rarely here during the day, so Claire had ignored his objections. After years together, she thought the maid knew her better than her husband did. "Nothing, Marta, thank you. I'll see you on Monday. But if your daughter isn't better by then, give me a call and we'll adjust your hours." For a moment, she wondered why they clung to the outdated notion that their home still required a maid twice a week. David spent more time at the office than he did in the oversized house he'd insisted they buy a decade ago in the ritzy neighborhood. Janie had always been relatively neat, and it wasn't like Claire didn't have the time to clean. But in the next instant, it occurred to her that without Marta, some weeks she would go days on end without anyone other than the family to talk to, mostly because making the effort with others seemed just that. With David away so much and Janie well ensconced in her high school world, the other woman's presence was sometimes a welcome distraction from her own moods. It wasn't that Marta was or had ever been a confidant, but it was impossible to keep the family dynamics from the help, and after all these years, she and Marta had developed a sort of verbal shorthand. "I've got your recyclables. We've got pickup tomorrow." The other woman lifted a white trash bag clutched in her hand that Claire knew would contain vodka bottles. She kept them beneath the bathroom sink in the guest bathroom, behind the cleaning supplies. Without it ever being mentioned, every week, Marta disposed of the empties. There had been a time when the unspoken knowledge inherent in the exchange would have shamed Claire, but she'd come to embrace it with a weary sort of gratitude. "Thank you, Marta. I don't know what I'd do without you." "You won't have to find out. See you next week." She disappeared down the hallway, and Claire sat silently, listening to the sound of the maid's receding footsteps. The house phone rang in their bedroom. She ignored it, lying down on the bed, cradling the glass against her chest, her face pressed into Kelsey's pillow. She could no longer smell her daughter's shampoo on it, but she drew some small comfort in curling up on the mattress the way Kelsey used to, her eyes on the room that had stayed precisely the same since the day her daughter had left it. Janie had always been the tidier of the two girls. She never needed reminding to hang up her things, to put her shoes in the closet, or to put her book bag away. Even now that she'd taken up smoking, she thought Claire didn't know. There were no signs of her habit in her room. Kelsey had been a dervish, running from one activity to the next. The blue sweater she'd worn on her last night home still lay on the floor. A pair of scruffy sneakers sat exactly where Kelsey had towed them off. A couple of books were carelessly tossed on the bed. Marta replaced each item precisely in the same spot when she cleaned. Claire's gaze wandered to the bookcase against one wall. The shelves were jammed with trophies and plaques from Kelsey's earliest years on the child beauty pageant circuit. If Claire had to choose, those years would stand out as her favorite memories with her daughter. David hadn't wholly approved of the entire scene and had rarely accompanied them. So it had just been Claire and Kelsey, going to dance lessons, singing lessons, photo shoots, and of course, the weekend contests themselves. She'd loved the time so much that she'd put off having a second child, even lying to David about trying to conceive when in reality, she'd still been taking the pill. She'd reveled in the glamour of it, the camaraderie and competition with other mothers, the time alone with her daughter, who'd done quite well in the pageants. It wasn't until David had suggested they see a fertility specialist that she'd reluctantly gone off birth control. She'd been pregnant within 3 months, and as she feared, Kelsey's pageant days were over a couple of years later. David had quickly grown tired of being left with Janie while Claire took Kelsey to lessons and competitions, and having Janie along had given Claire her first inkling that something was wrong with her youngest daughter. Even as a baby, her oldest had been sociable, holding out her arms to people who stopped to speak to her. Janie had been just the opposite, screaming with fear when strangers appeared, whether they spoke to her or not. David had never understood her love for those experiences with Kelsey, just as he hadn't understood her reaction to losing her. 4 years after their child had been taken, Claire had come home to find every single thing in her daughter's bedroom boxed up. The bed had been stripped, the closet emptied, walls and shelves bare. "It's time," David explained in that infuriatingly logical tone he had, as if an unseen clock had told the exact hour when all should be ready to accept the unacceptable. They'd had the worst fight of their lives then. For a long time, Claire hadn't been certain their marriage would survive it. She'd said hurtful things, horrid things. Some she'd meant, but others she hadn't. Just as she'd hoped that David hadn't meant all the invectives he'd hurled her way. After he'd slammed from the house, she'd set about like a woman possessed, returning the room to normal. Every article of clothing was replaced in dresser drawers and on hangers, every item to its place on the shelf, the same books positioned just so on the carefully mussed bed. She'd looked up once to see Janie framed in the doorway, watching her silently, an anxious expression on her face. That had shaken her. Although diagnosed in kindergarten with selective mutism, Janie had come a long way with the anxiety disorder, rarely showing symptoms at home, and only then if they had visitors. But Claire hadn't been able to go to her, to reassure her. How could she tell her daughter that everything would be all right when Claire knew nothing would be? Not ever again. Hours into her task, Marta had joined her without a word. Kelsey was a clever artist, and each of her drawings had been rehung on the wall, every trophy precisely positioned on the shelves. The other woman had known even better than Claire where each object belonged. That single act had cemented a relationship between them that had never been acknowledged verbally. It never needed to be. Her cell rang then. Claire considered not answering it, but withdrawing it from her robe pocket, she saw it was Barbara. Her friend had been known to come over, there was no answer, to check on Claire personally. It was a habit forged in those early days after Kelsey was taken. "Barbara," she forced a note of cheer she wasn't feeling into her voice. "Hello. I'm afraid you've caught me in the middle of something. What's up?" "Nothing much." Claire could imagine her friend sitting in her sunroom with her second oversized mug of coffee and the morning paper. "I haven't talked to you since the luncheon and thought I'd check in." Her early sense of contentment vanished. Claire rose to sit on the bed again and brought the glass to her lips, taking care so her friend wouldn't hear the ice cubes clinking together. I'm just fine. The lie tasted bitter on her lips. Trying to summon the ambition to go grocery shopping. I swear Janie inhales everything I bring home and never seems to gain an ounce. If I could clone her metabolism, I'd be set for life. Barbara laughed, as expected, but seemed distracted. That's good, then. I was afraid, after the talk at the luncheon, I was just hoping you weren't worrying yourself over the DeVries girl. Claire clutched the phone so tightly, the sides of it cut into her palm. Oh, well. Not even Barbara knew the extent of the state of panic and emotional turmoil she went through whenever she heard news like that. It was important to Claire that she didn't. Better to keep up at least the pretense that she'd moved on, rather than the rest of the world passing her by while she remained frozen in the past. Hearing news like that is always difficult. How are the parents holding up? Have you heard anything? You can imagine, I expect. Helen said Shannon is beside herself. I'm not sure how much support Brian is for her. I always thought he was sort of a hard man. Not that I'm judging, her friend hastened to say. But you and David, all through your ordeal, I was just so thankful you were there for each other, that you pulled each other through the worst experience parents can endure and came out closer than ever. Claire stared hard at the melting ice in her glass. Yes. Her voice was flat. We're very lucky that way. She should be grateful that the farce she worked so hard to present to the world was readily accepted, but the knowledge just made her feel empty. People saw what they wanted to see, whatever was most comfortable to believe. That tightness was back in her chest. Setting the glass on the bedside table, she fumbled in the pocket of her robe for a pill. After a moment's hesitation, she withdrew a second and swallowed them both, chasing them down with a gulp of vodka. I know this is terribly presumptuous of me, but I was wondering, if you feel up to it. Something in Claire stilled in anticipation of Barbara's next words. Maybe if it wouldn't be too terribly painful for you. Could you talk to Shannon? I'd come along, of course, but I'm sure she'd take a great deal of comfort in discussing things with you. As I said, I'm not sure how helpful Brian is, emotionally speaking, and of course he's going through hell, too. Perhaps even David. There was more, but Claire stopped listening. The phone was still clutched in her hand, still pressed against her ear, but Barbara's voice was very far away. Other noises had intruded, supplied by memory, honed excruciatingly sharp by years and pain. The sound of voices, Claire's raised, Kelsey's shouting, the anger and contempt, so hot and pulsing that it seemed to reverberate in the air, the stomp of her daughter's feet down the stairs, the slam of the door, and then the quiet, the awful echoing silence that had enveloped Claire as she was left to replay the hideous scene over and over, grappling with shock and sorrow while her mind frantically searched for comprehension, for options. Memory was sly that way. It had gotten harder and harder to cling to the exact sound of her daughter's laugh, the smell of her hair. But that final scene was branded indelibly in her mind. It often sprang forth unsummoned, an emotional ambush. Dimly she was aware of the cell vibrating in her hand. She didn't remember disconnecting the call. The screen didn't show Barbara's number this time, but Janie's school. Claire made no move to answer it. She couldn't. The past was rising up again, rushing in and dragging her back into the darkness.
David Willard, November 4th, 2:48 p.m.
Janie! David!
Claire gathered her robe around her and hurried down the stairway.
What are you two doing home?
David glared at her as he ushered his daughter through the front door. A better question would be, where the hell have you been? The dean of students tried calling you. I tried calling. I had to leave work to go to the high school. Have you been home all this time? His wife put a hand to her hair as she crossed the hall to them. I was just about to get into the shower. I've been sick all day and sleeping. I must not have heard the phone. His gaze narrowed. He couldn't recall the last time he'd seen his wife not immaculately groomed and attired by 8 a.m. She did look ill, pale, and a little shaky.
What happened? Janie, are you sick?
She pressed her hand to their daughter's forehead, only to have the girl duck away from her touch. Claire turned to David.
Are you going to tell me what's going on?
I'll let Janie do that. His daughter remained silent, and David suppressed a surge of impatience. He'd had to reschedule the creative content meeting on the Bonner campaign. He put his hand on Janie's shoulder and guided her into the family room. She tolerated his touch only slightly better than she had Claire's, but then she rarely showed him the obstinate side that she sometimes displayed to his wife. Something about mother-daughter relationships he'd heard about but didn't pretend to understand. Janie shrugged out of her backpack and dropped into the tan leather recliner that matched the couch. Claire stood before her uncertainly, swaying a little bit. David sent her another look, considering. Sick could look a lot like hungover, and the vodka she favored always seemed plentiful in the cupboard. But he took out the garbage, and he knew for a fact that there were only empty bottles in it after they'd entertained. He shook his head, banishing the half-suspicion, and focused on his daughter again. Claire reached out a hand to her, fingered the ugly scratch on the girl's neck.
Janie, what happened here?
Janie reached up to touch the mark where her mother's fingers lay, as if surprised by it.
I guess Heather must have scratched me. She was trying hard enough. Glad now that I bloodied her nose for her. Janie Lynn!
Claire's concern turned to shock.
You hit her?
Not exactly, David put in. Sit down, Claire. She looked like a stiff wind would blow her over. She walked unsteadily to perch on the edge of the nearby couch. He sat in a chair next to it. I got a call because Janie got into an altercation with another girl at school. His wife looked baffled.
An altercation? Janie? At school?
He couldn't blame her for her disbelief. He'd reacted similarly when Templeton had called his office. Throughout Janie's school career, the ongoing concern had been her lack of participation, her anxiety with verbal communication, never getting physical with another student. Voice dry, he answered. Yes, to both questions. And after my meeting with the Millers and the school personnel, I do believe she was provoked. He didn't miss the grateful look his daughter sent him. By the time he'd finished dealing with Lucy and Hal Miller, he'd been feeling more than a little violent himself. He'd wanted to kick Hal's ass, and it hadn't been the first time. Still looking stunned, Claire asked,
Who did you hit, Janie? Heather Miller. I didn't exactly hit her, although I'm sure she told a completely different story.
Janie shrugged.
She pushed me down, so when she offered her hand to help me up, I pulled her down, too. She cracked her face on her laptop.
A look of satisfaction fluttered across her expression.
It was like a faucet pouring out blood. Oh, Lord.
If anything, his wife went paler.
Not Lucy Miller's daughter.
Janie lifted a shoulder.
I don't know. I've never met her mother. If Lucy Miller covers mean-spirited bitchiness under a fake sweet phony facade, I'm guessing they're related.
David's mouth twitched. That's enough, Janie. The description fit Lucy Miller to a T. His daughter's situational communication problems aside, she was perceptive as hell. Maybe it came from all the time she spent listening rather than talking. Sometimes he worried that she was a little too observant. He sneaked a surreptitious look at his watch. The last thing he needed was to miss the rescheduled team meeting, too. The girl is Lucy Miller's daughter, he affirmed. Lucy and Hal Miller. The man was West Band's chief of police now, but 7 years ago, he'd been the lead investigator in Kelsey's case. And yeah, he'd been shoved aside when the BCI had been called in, but he'd still been involved. His inflection wasn't lost on his wife. She slumped deeper into the couch, as if it had swallowed her up, and David knew in that moment that he was going to have to give Claire a carefully abbreviated account of the conference.
Heather is using the whole Whitney DeVries thing to get in my head. Mrs. Rimble thinks she's trying to get an edge in grades and scholarships.
Janie looked vaguely surprised at the idea.
I didn't even figure Heather realized we were competing. Maybe she thought if she could provoke me, I'd do something bad enough to disqualify myself from Honor Society or teacher recommendations or something.
God. Claire's voice was faint, her hand at her throat, in that way she had when she was distressed.
I knew it. David, I told you. I knew that the DeVries girl...
Janie, you can go to your room. From the sounds of things, the girl had been through enough today, and he didn't want this scene to deteriorate into another one of his wife's meltdowns. He could control it, maybe, but not in front of his daughter. She'd been through a lot, too, in her young life. Sometimes he thought he and Claire forgot about how their tragedy had been Janie's tragedy, too. This afternoon had reminded him. Janie didn't need a second invitation. She was out of the room like a shot and headed for the stairs. He gave Claire an edited version of what had gone on with Janie at school that day, although the counselor, Mrs. Rimble, had been quite detailed about the things Heather had been overheard saying. Whoever said kids could be cruel had made a gross underestimation. Bunch of young cannibals was more like it.
Who was at the conference?
With a flicker of relief, David noted that Claire had revived a little. She was at least sitting up straighter, one hand jammed into a pocket of her robe, fingers fiddling with something. Booker, that counselor, Mrs. Rimble, the dean of students, Templeton, the Millers, and me.
It must have seemed odd that I wasn't there. How did you explain my absence?
Claire, try to focus. David leaned back in his chair, loosened his tie, and reached for calm.
I covered, all right?
Templeton is a bit of a weasel, and Lucy Miller was going on and on about her perfect daughter's soft heart and how she was probably just so concerned for Janie's state of mind, how she didn't mean any harm and how awful Janie was for causing Heather's injury. If Heather was half as annoying as her mother, David could easily understand why Janie had lost her cool. It had been the first time he'd met Lucy Miller, and he'd felt a similar urge. Templeton's got no backbone, so he may have backed the Millers, but Booker seemed fair. And that Rimble, I think she might be in Janie's corner. She was professional, but every time Templeton bent the Millers' way, she'd remind them of the emotional hurt that Heather had caused Janie.
Well, I'm certainly glad they aren't just blaming Janie in this, then.
He was relieved to see a spark of life return to Claire's expression.
It sounds like much ado about nothing. This is so unlike her, but she was obviously provoked. I've been on the receiving end of some of Lucy Miller's comments before, and if her daughter is anything like that witch, she's probably a nasty little piece.
Tired of the whole mess, David rubbed the back of his neck, eager to get back to work. They both got off pretty lightly. Each will serve an after-school suspension. The Millers objected, but the principal was adamant that their daughter had violated the school's anti-bullying policy. And the memory of that particular part of the meeting was satisfying. The other parents' angry protests, and the counselor providing moral support to keep that wimp Templeton standing firm. Heather serves hers tomorrow, and Janie will do so Friday. The girls are to stay the hell out of each other's way, and if there's more trouble, the repercussions will get more serious. He rose, straightened his suit coat, and re-knotted his tie. You might want to impress that bit of information on Janie.
I will.
Claire rose too, looked anxiously toward the doorway Janie had disappeared through.
Hopefully she's in the mood to listen.
Well, she will be if you use the right approach. Be supportive. We have no idea what she's been going through since that girl disappeared from Saxon Falls. He expected the sharp swivel of his wife's head, but plowed on, intent on making his point. For all we know, that Miller girl is the tip of the iceberg. Kids talk, just like adults do. This is hard on Janie, too. It's easy to lose track of that. The reminder was as much for himself as his wife. He felt a fresh stab of guilt for not keeping better tabs on what was going on in his daughter's life. But the introduction of the DeVries girl had a predictable effect on his wife. Her chin trembled.
I know you don't want to hear this, but the papers, one of the stories has already mentioned a possible link between Whitney DeVries's and Kelsey's disappearances. If there is, maybe the investigation this time around will...
Claire!
For once, think about the daughter we have and not the one we lost.
Out of patience and out of time, David walked through the door. The last thing he wanted to think about right now was Kelsey's investigation. He'd already had memories of it rubbed in his face, sitting in the principal's office facing that prick Hal Miller. He'd been an arrogant son of a bitch at their first meeting, and hadn't improved in the time since. When it had become apparent that the two girls were going to serve the same consequence, Miller had tried to throw his weight around. And when that hadn't worked, he transferred his attitude to David. He'd had plenty of the man's bullshit after Kelsey's kidnapping. There was no love lost between them, and time hadn't diminished the level of animosity, evidenced by Miller's last muttered remark to David as he'd brushed by him to leave the office.
Your performance of concerned father isn't any more convincing today than it was in my interview room 7 years ago. Bastard.
Special Agent Mark Foster, November 4th, 5:34 p.m.
No, we've been through this a dozen times.
Shannon DeVries plucked at the arm of the couch with quick, nervous movements.
Why aren't you doing something?
Her voice grew louder, a little wild.
Why aren't you finding my daughter instead of asking us the same questions over and over like a broken record?
She sprang up from the couch on that last word as if propelled and paced agitatedly.
It's like being stuck in that movie, Groundhog Day. We just keep reliving the same horrific hours, and nothing changes. You people are useless.
Mark glanced at Brian DeVries to gauge his mood. The man made no move to calm his wife and looked one step away from having his own outburst. Dealing with parents was always a minefield. Managing one who was law enforcement required a degree of diplomacy that Mark feared he hadn't yet acquired in his 12 years as an agent. Normally, the trick was to soothe and elicit information at the same time, to rewrap what they already knew with any new facts that could be shared to give them a sense of progression. DeVries saw through those efforts, and despite being a cop, he was as impatient as any other parent would be with less-than-lightning-speed results on his daughter's investigation. Mark couldn't totally blame him. If he were in the man's position, he'd be chewing glass by now. Don't think that because I'm here talking to you that nothing is being done for Whitney. Agent Craw is conducting more interviews as we speak. We've got local officers manning the tip line and investigators following up on every single lead that comes in. We've submitted details of your case to federal databases, and we follow up on each hit we get. We've got more personnel back at BCI headquarters chasing down details they don't have to be on scene for. He gave Shannon a reassuring smile. You've got a regular battalion working on your behalf, even if you don't see most of them. It was impossible for a civilian to understand the myriad paths this investigation had already explored, or the way each path would branch off for each of the tiniest facts. But he'd gotten Shannon's attention, and that was step one. She returned to the couch, sank down, seeming calmer. He felt a stab of empathy. When he became irritated, he just thought of Nikki, and how he'd feel if he were in the parents' place. The investigators would be ready to shoot him by now. Maybe that's why he was better suited than Craw to deal with the families. Thrice divorced, Ben had never had kids. He was still a hell of an agent, but had a harder time having his decisions constantly questioned by the victims' families. I can't think of anything more difficult than what the two of you are going through now. But we're making progress. He sat on the edge of the ottoman in front of the couch. The reason I asked again about boyfriends is that our warrants went through. We've gotten the cell phone data back for Whitney's cell, as well as preliminary forensic information from her social media sites. We focused on speaking to everyone she was friends with online that we haven't already interviewed. We found an irregularity in one of the Facebook accounts.
An irregularity?
Brian leaned forward, his dark gaze intense.
What does that mean?
Mark kept his voice conversational. There was a boy from Blackston that she was friends with online. She was communicating with him regularly, at first using Facebook chats, before they started text messaging. Shannon looked at her husband helplessly.
I don't understand. The only time Whitney is in Blackston is when we're at my mom's.
Her husband didn't spare her a glance.
So, who's the boy?
His name is Patrick Allen. Mark watched the two carefully. Does that ring a bell? Shannon shook her head. She was a petite blonde woman, nearly dwarfed by the oversized sofa.
I grew up in Blackston, but I don't recognize the name. Do you think he had something to do with Whitney's kidnapping?
We're not sure yet. Mark shifted his gaze to Brian. We've interviewed the boy, and he denies knowing your daughter, said he's been locked out of his Facebook account for months and hasn't been able to resolve the issue. He finally gave up and established a new one, and Whitney isn't a contact on it.
And you believe him?
Ignoring the belligerence in the other man's tone, Mark replied, "We have no reason not to at this point. His father agreed to surrender the boy's cell and the family electronics. We also have Patrick's school-issued laptop. But the Allens were in Columbus visiting relatives the weekend Whitney went missing. Their alibi will be easy to verify. In fact, the team was in the process of doing that right now."
Relatives could cover up for him. Did he have access to a vehicle? Maybe he was luring Whitney on behalf of someone else. I wouldn't be so quick to write off this kid's involvement.
Brian's words came in short staccato bursts. We aren't. Mark's look encompassed both parents. We won't.
What?
Shannon's voice broke on the word, and she paused as if to steady herself before going on.
What did the messages say?
The chats were pretty innocuous. We're unable to get the content of the text messages, just the dates and times when they occurred. There were no phone calls, and although kids seem to favor Snapchat and Instagram over Facebook these days, there's no indication that they were communicating through those sites. Mark could tell from Brian's expression that the import of those facts wasn't lost on the man, but Shannon's brow furrowed.
I know Whitney has Snapchat because once in a while she shows me a picture she...
Comprehension dawned, and she looked stricken.
That's why, isn't it? He never called. He avoided sites that regularly used pictures because he isn't Patrick Allen at all.
Her words ended on a sob, and she buried her face in her hands. We're investigating that possibility. Mark noted how long it took Brian DeVries to move from his chair, go to his wife, and put his arm around her. Something about the act seemed awkward. Not for the first time, Mark wondered what they'd discover down the road about the couple's marriage. He didn't like this aspect of the investigation. The most delicate balancing act of his job was to show empathy for the hell they were going through, even before he could discount them as suspects. But statistics didn't lie, and a significant percentage of crimes against juveniles were committed by the parents. So one of the things he wasn't telling the DeVrieses was the number of hours he and Craw were spending corroborating their statements, looking into their backgrounds, their financials, their relationship. Inwardly, he squirmed at the thought, scratched the surface, and many marriages would show flaws and weaknesses, even his own, especially his own. Pushing aside the thought, he continued. That's why I asked again about a boyfriend. Do you recall Whitney ever mentioning a new friend? Hinting that she was communicating with someone different?
She wouldn't do that. Tell us, I mean.
Brian's voice was flat.
She's 14. She isn't allowed to date for another 2 years. She knows that's non-negotiable with us. And if I had heard there was a boy she was talking to, she would have had to answer a lot of questions. Part of having a cop for a father.
Maybe she mentioned something to your son?
Ryan?
Shannon raised her head, wiping away tears.
Doubtful.
He's a thorn in her side most of the time.
Totally normal sibling dynamics,
she hastened to add.
If he suspected anything, he'd have taunted her, probably at the top of his lungs.
Believe me, I'd have heard about it. I'd still like to talk to him.
He's napping.
And from the tone of Brian's voice, the kid would be undisturbed this evening.
Ryan is still a bit under the weather, as you can imagine. He's pretty worked up about his sister. He isn't sleeping well at night.
Mark nodded. Another time, then, when he's feeling better.
Have you traced the devices that the communications to Whitney were coming from?
Brian asked. He knew how to hide his tracks online. There are a number of ways he could have hacked the boy's Facebook account. A phishing scam, sending him a link to click on. He probably used a VPN so his IP address couldn't be traced. All this was supposition. It all boiled down to the fact that there'd be no leads from the offender's computer. His phone was a burner. DeVries uttered an ugly oath and looked away, his throat working. He obviously grasped the significance of that detail. Disposable phones came without contracts, without identified users. There were legitimate reasons to buy them, but they were difficult to trace, and that fact would appeal to someone with something to hide. Mark continued. The I got the phone number for the burner from your daughter's cell records. We've discovered the network provider of the offender's phone and obtained a dump of all the transmissions to and from that number. It was used only to communicate with Whitney. We've installed a trap in the system